Hello and welcome to this very special addendum to Tolkien Day, discussing Tolkien and his relationship with history. I am very lucky to be joined by the esteemed Professor of Medieval History, Rachel Fulton Brown, who is also a Tolkien scholar. Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me. And thank you for scheduling a special with me because I couldn't do Monday.
No, that's absolutely fine, even though it's slightly belated. You are, in addition to my wonderful other guests, a celebrity cameo, so to speak, within Tolkien circles. So I'm very happy to have you on. Now, I've already had a conversation or a series of conversations on this channel relating to, you can say, the cauldron of story regarding the mythological, the scripture, and the historical inspirations for Tolkien in the Third Age specifically, with my collaborator on Tolkien Day, Nathan Hood. So I was wondering for this stream, because obviously we've gone over various aspects, you know, poetry, Tolkien's relationship with the English literature establishment, whether we could try and elucidate some of Tolkien's thoughts on the subject of history and glean any sort of broader, you know, inspirations for the legendarium. So first of all, do you have any sort of introductory remarks you want to make about Tolkien's relationship with the subject of history?
Well, I have some questions, since this is coming on the you know, after several other discussions you've had. Just also to double check, is my sound okay? Because I you break up a little bit and we had that internet problem getting started. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you perfectly.
Okay, great. When you've talked about history, have you talked about the Notion Club papers and Asterix history and the toss-up with Lewis on space and time and that sort of thing? Because that's one of the things that I think is really important to understand how Tolkien theorized his stories. Has that been part of your conversation yet?
Not so far. So would you like to introduce us to this?
Okay, that's excellent. All right. So setting up with history, I mean, one of the things that people always want to know is, like, you know, to what extent is Tolkien writing, you know, something that's a world building, right? They're always talking about him saying, you know, if they're modeling their own writing on Tolkien, they want to participate in world building, making it sound like they're making up the world from scratch. Right. And it's interesting that people think that that's copying Tolkien, because that's exactly what he didn't do, at least in his own understanding of how he came to the history of what he called Middle Earth. And again, I'm just a little self-conscious of sort of stepping in the middle of all the sorts of conversations you've had, including stepping into the middle of describing what Middle Earth means. Right. And that Middle Earth, as I hope you know, is the it's the Old English, Middle English term, simply for our, as Tolkien would put it, our habitation, right? It's in fact our Earth, right? Mm. So when he said his stories in what he called Middle Earth, he meant it to be, in fact, our own landscape, right? And when I teach my course at Chicago in Tolkien, or if you have seen some of my unauthorized videos, we talked about this. If you can try mapping Tolkien's landscape onto basically Europe, right? And there's one of his letters, he has a discussion of saying, well, you know, Oxford is probably the Shire is probably at the latitude of Oxford or whatever, and Gondor is down there probably at the latitude of, I don't know, Constantinople or Rome or something like that. So there's a sort of climate mapping, obviously, in the story, but there's also very significantly a conceptual mapping. And the sort of hook to all of that is to realize that what Tolkien thought he was doing was writing a time travel story, right? He's not, in fact, writing a made-up world, a fantasy world. He's actually, throughout his legendarium, writing what he thought of as history. And the best place to go for his theorizing about what he was doing was the Notion Club papers, which is in it's in Sauron Defeated, so it's in the History of Middle Earth, Volume 9. Yeah. And are you familiar with that, the setup in the Notion Club papers? It's a wonderful sort of fiction of Tolkien and his, you know, fellow Inklings having one of their conversations fictionalized about what it would be like to write a time travel story, right? And in that conversation, there's some very interesting sort of nods to the kind of theoretical framework that Tolkien was working with. It's like, how would you write a time travel story? What kind of mechanism would you use to get your character back in time? And comparing it explicitly in the conversation with the kind of space travel story that Lewis was writing, right? So let me know whether this is where you want to we can go with this, right?
No, this is fantastic. Please continue.
Okay, you're just gonna let me lecture. Okay, fine. I will give the lecture that I also can do. So to understand, and I'll do it the way I do it on my Forge of Tolkien on Unauthorized, which is, you know, throw books at you and say, here's the passage that you need to be thinking about. So the first thing comes in Tolkien's On Fairy Stories, right, where he is, you know, in that famous essay where he's describing what it means to create a secondary reality that you know, you can enter into and participate in. And there's this wonderful moment at the end where he's talking about Christianity, which I know is one of your themes, and how, in fact, the Gospels are the fairy story, right? That it's not just that they're a kind of fairy story, but they are, in fact, he says, a story of a larger kind, which embraces the essence, all the essence of fairy stories.
Yeah.
And the reason that it embraces all the essence of fairy stories is because he says, this story, the gospel, right? So our Christian story, our reality, our you know, incarnate experience, this story has entered history. And there's a capital H, history, right? And the primary world. The desire and aspiration of subcreation has been raised to the fulfillment of creation. The birth of Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history. The eucatastrophe being the sort of happy turn, the joyous turn from sorrow to grace, right? That he describes as characteristic of fairy stories. So that his first and primary claim about history is there is this fairy story that's entered into history. And in this fairy story, he says, it's the one that people most want to believe, understand as true, right? He says, this story is supreme and it is true, the gospel. Art has been verified. God is the Lord of angels and of men and of elves. Legend and history have met and fused. And it's that last phrase that I think is really important here. He said, legend and history have met and fused. What on earth does he mean by that, right? And that's where the Notion Club papers become very important, because the characters in that fiction, right? And maybe I should set up that a little bit more clearly for your audience, are talking explicitly about the relationship between myth and history, right? And the sort of what happens if you travel back in time? Do you get just more history, or do you get something else? Do you get this sort of mists of time kind of experience, right? So that's what we're trying to understand, how this legend and history can have met and fused, and why therefore the whole legendarium that he's writing is actually taking place in our Middle Earth, right? In our our own habitation, right?
Yeah.
It's like I recognize that this is not my lecture, right? So please ask questions if you want me to stop.
Interesting. I think
I can monologue with the best of them. Go ahead.
Often in this case, I've also had Charles Coulomb on here, both to talk about history in regards to Blessed Charles, but also on for Talking Day. And invariably, you know, when I have a guest on, I do tend to lecture. I do tend to overwhelm with bamboozle information with a script. But I thought precisely why I wanted to have you on in particular is because I've almost presented my own rendition of not the overarching philosophy of history, but in particular, some various aspects. So, for example, I've gone into the the story of creation. I've talked about the various historical inspirations for Rohan in particular. I've discussed the works of Tom Shippey. I've discussed the various historical allusions to Gondor. I've discussed the notion of kingship, for example. So when we're talking about the Notion Club papers and this conception of essentially the work of Lord of the Rings as a almost, you know, a work of time travel, this is again something which I'm only sort of very faintly familiar with, and whilst I, you know, wouldn't claim any sort of particular expertise in this part, I'm more than willing to let you, you know, elaborate for us, because again, in the scheme of things, you are very much the expert and I am the listener.
Okay, well, actually that helps me though. So you've been talking about the sort of particular cultures and languages and settings that inspire specific elements in Tolkien stories. What I'm trying to point to is this sort of larger conceptualization of how do we connect with that story, which is one of the things that Tolkien was always very interested in. He has this problem of framing, right? So the Notion Club papers, the delightful thing about the Notion Club papers, one, they exist only in draft, right? And it's one of those things that Christopher, when we're talking about Tolkien, we're now sort of talking about Tolkien father and son constantly, yeah, right? Because Christopher gave us so much of the working materials that he gives us the potential to theorize behind the stories, right? Because he's you know, editing all of his father's papers and giving us all of this. But Notion Club papers, it's not an old draft or redrafting of the Lord of the Rings or the Silmarillion or anything like that. It's as I said, it's this sort of fictionalized meeting of the Inklings, renamed as all different characters, right? So it's actually a little tricky to figure out which ones are which, because all of them are a little bit Tolkien, right? There's this John Jethro Rashbold is one of the figures, born 1965, which I love because that's when I was born. But Rashbold is a pun on Tolkien, right? That's actually what the name means, Tolkien, right? But there's also a character, Raymer, who's the philologist, Alwyn Arundel Loudham, who's chiefly interested in Anglo-Saxon Icelandic and comparative philology. It's like and there's like a dozen characters or so. These Notion Club paper characters are meant to model the way in which Lewis and Tolkien and Hugo Dyson and, you know, Owen Barfield and their other friends got together and brainstormed their creative projects, right? Brainstormed their conversations. But in a way, all of the Notion Club papers are obviously Tolkien talking to himself about how he, as a philologist, Professor Finno-Ugaritic philology. There's a professor of psychoanalysis and gardening. That's Rupert Dolbear. He's asleep a lot in the opening. there's Wilfred Trewin Jeremy, who's a university lecturer in English literature and so forth. So it's like Tolkien has broken himself down into these different voices to imagine the problem that he's given himself of how would you write, in fact, a time travel story. But there's other sort of tricks and jokes in the whole point of the Notion Club papers. They are, according to the editor within the fiction, right, they're discovered after the summer examinations of 2012, right? So they're projected into the future and then backwards again. It's kind of fun. On the top of one of a number of stacks of waste paper in the basement of the examination schools at Oxford by the present editor, Mr. Howard Green, the clerk of the schools. And so Green sets you up to claim, I found these papers, these notes in 2012. There's a date, and then he supposedly edits them and publishes them in 2014. There's the meetings that are taking place in these minutes are supposedly taking place in the 1980s, which is funny, right? But the paper seems to come from earlier than that, right? So, you know, it's like the jokes that Tolkien put in Farmer Giles of Ham, where he has, you know, it's a lecture that he gave, and in fact, it's a story, but in fact, the story is actually about figuring out what the place named Thames means, right? Because it's the tame dragon, right? So there's this scholarly joke of we as medievalists will look at the manuscript, we'll look at the handwriting, we'll look at the dates on the papers, we'll look at when, you know, it was actually edited. And he, as setting this all up for you potentially as the reader is framing just the entry into these minutes of this conversation that they're about to have about what history is. Yeah. And that is that's, you know, the first level of understanding what Tolkien was as a writer is that he, you know, it's interesting looking at his scholarly output because it's not great compared to his notes on his legendarium, right? He everyone knows he was a philologist. He was, you know, concerned with the history of languages. He did editing work, right? He worked on the edition of the Ankarin Vissa, which is a handbook for anchoresses living the religious life. He did the work on Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. He has the translation of the Pearl and so forth. He's always in his own scholarship thinking through the layers of how do we come to this text, right? You have to think about what the language is for the Ankarin Vissa. You have to think about the manuscript history of how we get these texts. And in his own fiction writing, he's adding those frames too, right? If you know, like in the Lord of the Rings, there's the frame on the title page, right? There's the runes and the Tengwar, and it's actually in English, but it's a joke about how this is the book that Bilbo and Frodo wrote, right? The Downfall of the Lord of the Rings. So you're always coming to Tolkien with his self-awareness of our need for entry into the story somehow, right? That there's a frame and you're worrying about that. And that's what his characters in the Notion Club papers are actually talking about. And the first thing they talk about is the kinds of frames that they really dislike, right? That they they're saying they're specifically talking about the space travel story, which I've alluded to. So everyone knows Lewis writes the space trilogy, right? The Out of the Silent Planet, Pure Lyndra, and That Hideous Strength, and that Tolkien in his letters explains that, you know, he and Lewis were having these conversations about how nobody seemed to write the kinds of stories we like to read. So I guess we'll have to write our own. And we did a toss up and Lewis was going to do space travel and I was going to do time travel. And that's why, you know, they talk about both of their projects as science fiction, right? It's science fiction that they're both writing. So the Lord of the Rings, you think it's fantasy. It's actually science fiction in this sort of high level of theorizing. How do we create a believable entry, right? And in the Notion Club papers, the first thing they're talking about is how in space travel, right? It's deadly if the mechanism that the author uses to get the characters into the story is too clunky, right? And there's I think it's sort of funny because in Out of the Silent Planet, right, the mechanism is that, you know, crystal bullet basically. Oh, put Raymer in a coffin and shoot him into the stars, and oh look, now he understands the celestial harmonies and so forth. And so there's a little ribbing at like what kinds of conversations they must have had as the Inklings about does this work as a device to convince your reader that it's true, right? That how do you get them into that secondary reality? And they talk about the problem of the frame, right? He says, Raymer says something like, it's just like you, Nicholas, to pick on the frame, which is an awkward necessity of pictures and easy to change anyway and say nothing about what's inside it. And they say, well, no, you don't get away with the excuse that the picture frame is just a device, right? It has to have a sense of reality, otherwise the story won't work. The story is going to break, right? Remember, all along this, we're trying to figure out how legend and history meet and fuse. and the device, interestingly, that Tolkien came to, and Lewis and some of the others were also playing with this, was dreams, right? And there's a whole other sub lecture in this if you pay attention to the places in the Lord of the Rings where the characters have dreams, right? For example, when the hobbits are in the house of Tom Bombadil and Frodo has the dream of Gandalf at Orthanc, right? You can see him And one of the you know, the fascinating and lovely things about reading The Lord of the Rings is you know, then they have to figure out exactly what day it was, right? When exactly was the dream? You know, is it in the future? Is it in the past? You know, when you realize that Frodo is like, he's seen at a distance, but he's also seen in time. And Tolkien mapped all of that out really carefully. He loved chronologies. You have all those, you know, lists of dates and events and things in the appendices, and in the history of Middle Earth, there's all those other annals, right? More and more lists and dates. He's constantly like correlating, you know, what happens exactly at what time. And so nothing that he did was like accidental chronologically. And the dreams, for example, Frodo's dream of Gandalf at Orthanc, or the sensation that the characters have in the Fellowship when they go into Lorien and lose track of time. And then when they're leaving, they feel like they've been in a dream, right? It's like attune yourself to the number of times that the characters talk about, are they in a dream or are they in reality? And at the very end of the Hobbit's journey, when they come back to the Shire, there's a little conversation between Frodo and Mary, and now I can't remember which way it goes. It's like one of them says, I feel like we've been in a dream and we're waking up, and the other one says, no, I feel like we've just fallen asleep. This is a clue to the actual like technical device that Tolkien thought he was going to use in creating his time travel story. And what's interesting about it is that there was believed to be in the time that they're having these conversations, the Inklings, an actual scientific basis for this kind of time travel in dreams.
that is interesting. Would you like to expound upon that slightly?
Oh yes, of course. So this I get from Verlyn Flieger, A Question of Time. She goes beautifully into how Tolkien and Lewis draw on this philosophizing about time travel. And the source that they use is a book by J.W. Dunn that was called An Experiment in Time. And Dunn, he has claimed to fame as like an aeronautical engineer and such, but he tried to do this scientific record of dreams that he had, because he started having this sense that he was dreaming things that then happened, right? And he, you know, does it anecdotally, and he collects a lot of stories and stuff. But then he tried to explain a kind of mechanism for the widening of attention, that if you could just widen your attention properly, you could kind of find yourself. They're all reading, you know, relativity stuff and everything in the period too. It's the 20s and 30s. And Dunn has this idea that you could actually time travel by training yourself in dreams to widen your frame of reference.
Yeah.
Right. And what the characters in the Notion Club papers do is test this, right? They talk about it, and they're, you know, at one point, for example, they're talking about things like, you need to have the right machine to set the tone for the device that you want to do and such. And so, you know, having the dream characters, the dream travel actually work really mattered, because Tolkien didn't want it. He didn't want to feel like these stories were made up. He wanted to feel like the Lord of the Rings and everything else to feel like you'd simply traveled in time by way of, well, how, right? This widening of attention, and that you could train yourself to do it, right? And in the Notion Club papers, he has Raymer explain, you know, how he does this sort of dream travel by like attaching, there's a meteorite in the park, and he goes and he attends in such a focused way to the meteor that he's able to go on these space journeys by tapping into the meteor's memories somehow. you've figured out Tolkien, and then you realize he's trying to play with this sci-fi stuff even more generally, right? So Raymer's describing one of these dreams that he's been training himself in, and saying, you know, that he seems to be able to travel to other places. For example, he gets to this one called Tekel Murum, Says, I don't know why I visited this strange scene for Wake. I've never studied crystallography, not even though the vision of Tekel Mirim has often suggested that I should. Whether things go in Tekel Mirim exactly as they do here, I cannot say. All the same, I wonder still, what on earth or in the universe? Excuse me. You shouldn't ask me more questions. Can be meant by saying, as was said 100 years ago by Huxley, I believe, that a crystal is a symmetrical solid shape assumed spontaneously by lifeless matter. The free will of the lifeless is a dark saying, but I merely record or try to record the events I saw, and they were too marvelous while I could see them in far off Tekel Mirim for speculation. Right. So he's managed by way of sitting himself beside this meteor to travel into space and to find all these crystalline objects. And then in sort of concluding scene, he has this experience where he's kind of zooming back in, right? It's very cinematic, right? He's zooming back in and he's looking and he says, he sees that he's in a location where there's something that he thought was a quick growing fungus until I looked more steadily, but now I saw they were buildings, but still fungus buildings appearing and then falling to pieces. And yet their agglomeration was spreading. I was still rather high above it all, higher than a man in a very tall tower. I could see the place was crawling or rather boiling with now of some sort. Da, 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 da. And he's like, this is really frightful. What it is? What is it? What is it? What is it? And then he realizes he's looking at the Radcliffe camera and he's looking at Oxford. Right. Yeah. So it's Tolkien wanted you, by way of this dream travel and the time travel, which we're still working on, to feel like you were actually, it's all one universe, right? There's one creation that all of this is happening in. And it's to a certain extent change of perspective and attention, but it's not another universe or world made up. It's Middle Earth that all of this is going to be tied to.
So let me understand it. So all of this is tied to Middle Earth, and this is a means of approaching Middle Earth or trying to access it. So right. In that way, how essentially did Tolkien conceive of Middle Earth? Did he conceive it as a particular time and space somewhere in a particular era? Or was it, in a sense, a primordial era which predated all of known history, so to speak?
So this is where his, you said you'd read Shippey, right? And yeah. Shippey has that wonderful discussion of Asterix history, right? Where as the philologist, when you're studying a language, you have, you know, record in writing, if you have writing is tricky here, you have evidence of particular forms of words, right? And then as a historical philologist, which is, you know, what Tolkien's primary technical specialty was, right? There's a premise that you can, by way of understanding language change, I mean, it's very Tolkien's not really evolutionary at all, right? He's more, he appreciates the way art changes, right? It's about a skill and transformation that you can if you understand language properly, you can know from the present forms of the words what it would have been. Right. And the asterisk forms of the words are the ones there's no written evidence for. We have no historical record of them in our archive, but you can project that there must have been that word used in the past. Right. And in philological convention, you, as Shippey talks about, you sign that with an asterisk. Right. Yeah. So if you look in dictionary definitions in the etymological histories, yes, and you get to the word, you get to the word with the asterisk, that one is one for which we don't know, right? We have no actual primary evidence for it in our archive, but following proper philological scientific principles, you can say that word existed, right? Tolkien's doing that with everything, right? So he's taking, like you've looked at Rohan and the Anglo-Saxons, for example, or I know where Gondolin is supposed to be from. I mean, it's a walled city, right? So mountainous. I mean, a lot of there's John Garth's book on Tolkien's places. Have you read that one? Yeah. That's actually lovely, right? Where he's looking like they went on the walking tour in Switzerland, and you can see Rivendell in
Lauterbach,
right? Yeah, so it's like he's taking all of the things that we have in our present existence as pointers to the history that they came from. And if you study our world carefully, like, for example, the place name, the river named Thames, if you understand what Thames means, you find the tame dragon of Farmer Giles, right? Mm-hmm. That it's the clues are there if you know how to read them and to travel back in time with them, right? So you're saying, is it really history or what is it, right? Well, that's the other thing that once the Notion Club characters have had their conversation about dreams and travel and so forth, and Raymer has proved that, then they get into this discussion about going back in time, right? What that would mean. And Jeremy, that they start talking about particularly the this is a good place to go in. The conversation drifted again, so says the text. Starting from the beginnings of language, we began to talk about legends of origins and cultural myths. Guildford and Markison began to have an argument about corn gods and the coming of divine kings or heroes over the sea, in spite of various frivolous interjections from Loudoun, who seemed curiously averse to the turn of the talk. The sheaf personified, said Guildford. And then there, here, unfortunately, one leaf is missing, right? And the sheaf, it's the shield sheafing story that's at the beginning of Beowulf, right? And Tolkien played with that one a lot, saying, here's in Beowulf, which a poem which he had memorized backwards and forwards, right? There's one of these hints that you can project back. There must have been a fuller story, right? That's always his feeling, like there must have been a fuller story. And, you know, he loved the idea that, yes, Queen Elizabeth, you know, like the queen in the time that he's writing is a queen that's still queen now. So you can play this sort of the historical ripples carry back, right? Is related to probably an ancestor of this, you know, that if you follow the threads, and it's like, it's this journey, just like Raymer, you know, goes back with that meteorite, right? And follows the threads of the meteor back to the Tekel Mirim and the crystal worlds. You can, as a historian, follow those traces back into, well, where? And that's the Jeremy, as you said, this is like, there's the fiction is there's a leaf missing. Okay. Yeah. But I don't think one can be so sure. Sometimes I have a queer feeling that if one could go back, one would find not myth dissolving into history, but rather the reverse, real history becoming more mythical, more shapely, simple, discernibly significant, even seen at close quarters, more poetical and less prosaic, if you like. In any case, these ancient accounts, legends, myths about the far past, about the origins of kings, laws, and the fundamental crafts are not all made of the same ingredients. They're not holy inventions. And even what's invented is different from mere fiction. It has more roots. One of them asked, roots in what, said Frankly. In being, I think I should say, Jeremy answered, and in human being, and coming down the scale, in the springs of history and in the designs of geography. I mean, well, in the pattern of our world as it uniquely is, and of the events in it as seen from a distance. So this is the closest that I know that Tolkien got to explicitly theorizing that relationship between myth and history. He sort of points to it in fairy stories and on fairy stories, but here they're sort of, and I think he's getting a lot of this from Barfield, like poetic diction, Barfield's poetic diction. What happens if you can travel back in time? What is it like? Right. And the characters here are playing with this idea that history becomes more mythical the further back you go. And that is a linguistic claim that Barfield makes in poetic diction, that the further back you go in time, the more sort of the concrete, the abstract and the symbolic in our languages are all still combined, right? And the example that Barfield gives is spirit, right? Spiritus, that originally he says it means both breath and wind and soul altogether. And we have a sense that these are just three, see, we have different words for them now, but the further you would go back in this imagining, the more mythical reality actually is, right?
Yeah.
You know, for example, Arthur, King Arthur, and then they go on to start talking about King Arthur some, and trying to understand. It's like, was King Arthur real? And he's like, well, he was more real than history, because in fact, the myth that we find in the, you know, we travel back in time is the reality, is the history.
Yes, these are aspects which he basically says, you know, the cauldron of story, and we're talking about the precedence which, you know, precedence which, you know, a historian will assign to certain figures, and then we talk about these ideas of mythical elements added to this cauldron of story. But there are certain particular aspects which I want to go into regarding the how we construe Lord of the Ring. Obviously, Tolkien famously said he despised allegory. Yet, if we're looking at this as some sort of primordial history. When I was discussing this with Nathan Hood, I couldn't help but read real history into some of the events. So, if I say, take for example, the history of Gondor, there are many sort of allusions. You know, one you've drawn to in terms of the geographical aspect of this is, of course, tying this either to Rome or Constantinople. One thing you can draw with this, you know, is there some possible allusion to the Kingdom of Israel in that? One particular sort of hypothesis I've had is linking this back to two events. Obviously, one is the when we talk about the siege of Minas Tirith, is the you know siege of Constantinople in 1453, but you link that even further back, and I posit that possibly Minas Ithil, turning Minas Morgul, is in many ways could be construed as a surrogate for Constantinople. That and the symbolism of this, you know, if we're going to use the Ottoman advance as some sort of again analogy to the advance of Mordor, and say for example we take Osgiliath, which was you know an original capital of Gondor, as some sort of Budapest. And then move on to Minas Tirith, and then Minas Tirith becomes not Constantinople, but Minas Tirith becomes Vienna. And when we look at Theodoric the Great's King Theoden, he is not a Theodoric's Theoden King from you know the Battle of Chalons in 1451, but he becomes Jan Sobieski. So my question is, there's almost, you know, real history you can read into in terms of the primordial aspect, in terms of you mentioned this idea of philological reconstruction. However, I can't help but also read many different eras in the history in Lord of the Rings. So, for example, we talk about, you know, 1453 to 1683. We're talking about, you know, early modern history. When I look at Rohan, for example, you bring the very, you know, conscious example of, you know, some form of reimagining of the story of Beowulf, particularly with Meduseld and Edoras. There are also, you know, certain aspects I draw which are, you know, what essentially, how can you conceive of Rohan? I mean, of course, in addition to you know, early Germanic languages, Tom Shippey discusses Tolkien's fascination with Gothic and East Germanic. And of course, linking this back to etymological roots, I believe Horsa, taking the etymology of Horsa and linking this back to horse. And so, for example, imagining that this primordial sort of ancient kingdom of the Mark essentially etymologically came from horse, and therefore it is a version of England, a version of the Kingdom of Mercia, envisioned etymologically through the idea of the horse. And you know, link this also back to the great plains of what we now call Crimea, where the imagined sort of kingdom of the Eastern Goths were. And but then you also draw in, I draw in other parallels. So for example, the relationship between Constantinople and the Peripeteia, i.e. the Goths in the Crimea. And what I see is many elements which you can draw. For example, bringing this back to the Kingdom of Mercia, we're talking the Dark Ages, we're talking, you know, the 6th century to before Athelstan's unification of England in 927. But with the case of Constantinople, we're talking about, you know, again, the early modern period and the very late medieval period. And then, of course, there is the idea of the how do the hobbits play in this? I mean, to my mind, the conception of the Shire is almost timeless in the sense when we're looking at it historically, in terms of their language, for example, they speak a form of language which is much closer approximation to how people would have spoken in the 20th century, compared to, say, for example, the older version of Old English spoken by Rohan. And so, to my mind, especially when you sort of see the Hobbit as being brought in later, there are many aspects to the Hobbits in particular that seem rather historically anachronistic. So, at the same time, you know, we mentioned this idea of this elaborate form of time travel, yet at the and again this idea of philological reconstruction. But I'm, you know, trying to understand this whilst also reading into all of these events, real history, real potential analogies, and really trying to understand how we can situate these places in space and time, if that makes sense.
Yes. But I'd say framing that, why does it matter? Right. Mm. It's like, what is your longing for his story to connect with all of those other stories? Can you hear my cat? She started up.
Slightly, yes. Slightly.
The dog is asleep. The cat, unfortunately, has started on her. This is why there's no cats in the stories. That I think what I would want to know is why does that appeal to you so much, right? Why in your reading the stories is there that longing to find all of those connections, and why that sort of feels so much richer if you feel like that there is that element in Tolkien's crafting of his stories? I did a review this summer for Holly Ordway's book on Tolkien's modern reading. Have you read that one yet?
No, not yet, no.
So I did this kind of, I don't know whether the twist was clear in the version that I published, right? But I had this frustration when I was reading her book, because she kept ruining everything for me by showing, oh no, in fact, you know, that magnificent battle that Tolkien describes of, there's a really great, I think it's William Morris's, that's the right book. It's one that I hadn't read, descriptions of like the Goths in Rome or something like that. And you can, you know, go word for word from passages. And this is what she does throughout the book, you know, showing you passages after passage after passage that Tolkien got from actually modern authors that he was reading. Right. And I think that the most heartbreaking one Inglesant, right? In that one where there's a passage that Ordway says, this is probably where Tolkien got the original inspiration for talking about the feeling of joy like swords poignant as grief in the response of Sam to the battle of, to the Cormallan field, Fields of Cormallan, right? When the bard comes out and starts singing. I'm like, darn it! I wanted that to be Tolkien's own invention, and you show me that he's probably reading it somewhere else, right? So and I was interested because, you know, in other contexts, I've been quite happy to find, you know, oh, look, when he's reading Beowulf, and certainly the scene in Medusel is, you know, straight out of the challenge that the border guard gives to Beowulf his company and so forth. So, you know, I think there's a kind of aesthetic and psychological intriguing thing for me was, why was I mad after I finished reading her book? You know, that she's like basically shown me that Tolkien's completely derivative of people I don't even respect as authors, right? They're ordinary, they're, you know, third rate storytellers.
And I think just to preempt the point I'm making, I do apologize profusely if I have aggravated you in my analysis. I don't mean to show.
I have an answer. Analysis.
All right.
but so what I'm curious, you know, what's curious is like, when does this kind of, and the thing is, I respond that way because my students in my class often worry about that, right? They you know, they'll say to me, they're worried for a lot of reasons because people do a lot of things to modern text right now. But I think they are also, you know, worried about what Tolkien points to in the Beowulf the essay, where, you know, you have this gorgeous tower from which you can see the sea, which John Garth very nicely shows us was actually probably a real tower in Oxfordshire that people were complaining about. So it's kind of an inside joke, but there's a tower from which you could see the sea, and the scholars come in and knock it all down and then worry about what a muddle it's in, because it's just rocks, right? So there's at what point are we delighting in Tolkien's creativity and his ability to give us this feeling of being in this amazingly true story that then has these, all of these ripples and resonances into real history, right? And at what point are we frustrated and angry by that exercise? And what's interesting is in the Notion Club papers, they go on to be talking about this sort of relationship between myth and history. And they're worrying about, you know, does this going back in time and finding the myth just erase true history? Where is the power in that, right?
Yeah.
And for example, there's a sort of, you know, little internal joke here. Raymer muttered, considering. Yes and no, he said. Nicholas could, especially into the scenes that he's pictured or repictured fairly solidly and put some mental work into. We could, if we did the same, go back in time, right? Or the things. People of future, if they only knew the records and studied them and let their imagination work on them till the Notion Club became a sort of secondary world set in the past, they could, right? It was a joke there. It's hard to pull excerpts from this because it's in a conversation, right? The joke there is, look, you could take our actual minutes and project them and pretend they're fictional when we know they're real, but it's a fiction, right? So yeah. Tolkien, he's always self-conscious of this problem of inserting yourself into the story. But I think what Raymer responds in this moment is, in fact, what he's trying to grasp, right? So let me set this up. Yes, frankly, said Jeremy, you've got to make a distinction between lies or casual fiction or the mere verbal trick of projecting sentences back by putting the verbs into the past tense, between all that and construction, especially of the major kind that has acquired a secondary life of its own and passes from mind to mind. They're talking about storytelling and the problem of, like, how do you create this sense of going back, right? Quite so, said Raymer. I don't think any of us realize the force, the daimonic force that the great myths and legends have. From the profundity of the emotions and perceptions that begot them, and from the multiplication of them in many minds, and each mind, mark you, an engine of obscured but unmeasured energy. They are like an explosive. It may slowly yield a steady warmth to living minds, but if suddenly detonated, it might go off with a crash. Yes, might produce a disturbance in the real primary world. They're meditating on the power of stories and the, in our current moment, for example, when I was just listening to Matthias Desmond talk about mass formation, I've also been meditating a lot on the electrical media that Tolkien obviously was living in, and we are very much living in now. The power of all of these minds, like, resonating together. Tolkien is writing in a period when they mainly have radio, right? And they mainly have this power of voice that they can all listen to at the same time. I've also been reading a lot of Marshall McLuhan, and I think there's an explanation for Sauron in here, which is what we get to in not too long in this. We're going to have Sauron show up in this conversation. That Tolkien and contemporaries, they're very worried about this, you know, force. You see the language that there's daimonic force, unmeasured energy. Remember when they were playing with the science fiction of the time travel and the dream stories, they're also trying to understand basically electricity, right? This is an electrical power of charging the whole world with stories and telling things. This is new to my argument. This is new stuff for you rather than stuff I've used before. Trying to understand the way in which all of us can be hearing the same stories at the same time, and they create this, like, cataclysmic change in the present, in the primary world. And to respond to this, Raymer comes up with, well, I wasn't thinking of any particular legend, said Raymer, but, well, for instance, think of the emotional force. Again, this sort of, we know what this feels like right now, what we've all been living through in the world in the past 2 years, which I think matters a lot, because Tolkien lived through one of those moments in World War I and then again in World War II, right? It's going back to, it's not allegory, it's history. It's the feeling of what it is like to be caught up in one of these moments when the story is so powerful and the story is so real. And that certainly happened in the Great War, right? That they all ended up in the trenches. It's happening. It happened again, not the atomic bomb, but the atomic energy, the power of the mind that brought together the cataclysm that we call World War II. And, you know, there's been others, obviously, but the last 2 years, the pandemic, I think, is another of these, this daimonic force, the immeasurable energy of all of these minds resonating with the same emotional power, right? Okay, but this is the example that Raymer's about to give. Think of the emotional force generated all down the west rim of Europe by the men that came at last to the end and looked on the shoreless sea, unharvested, untraversed, unplumbed. And against that background, what a prodigious stature other events would acquire, say, the coming apparently out of that sea, riding a storm of strange men of superior knowledge, steering yet unimagined ships. And if they bore tales of catastrophe far away, battles, burned cities, or the whelming of lands in some tumult of the earth, it shakes me to think of such things in such terms, even now. Now, that is Tolkien by way of Raymer, by way of the fiction that this is an actual conversation, referring to the Numenorean legend, which he's going to work into the Notion Club papers, but which is also like the background of what's Gondor, right? It's the survivor, it's the foundation. The survivors of drowning of Numenor. And, you know, that it's another famously that dream. It's like Tolkien had that dream of the wave, which he puts in these characters' experience. Mm-hmm. Tolkien is a powerful storyteller because he's thinking in terms of the psychological, emotional power of stories. He never says that except through his characters, right? But I think what's going on, it's like this is, Shippey talks about him as a great modern writer, right? The most modern thing Tolkien does is tap into our psyches. So I'd say that's why you're fascinated by finding all those resonances in this different histories and such. Tolkien is trying to get you to the point of feeling the power of that event mythically. And so I think it works in the reverse, right? You can feel what the fall of Constantinople was like because you've read Gondolin.
Yes. And I think this is just to
the description of the
sorry, you're cutting out a tiny bit there, but I can luckily follow most of what you're saying. But no, other than that, I just wanted to emphasize that when I'm focusing on these particular aspects of, you know, what I read into the individual cultures or whatever, I'm not sort of gaining appreciation or trying to isolate them and say, you know, oh, well, Tolkien was, you know, derivative of that, or taking inspiration from that, or I don't know, the names and of the dwarves and the Hobbit, for example. I'm not trying to focus on the minutiae, but rather I'm trying to summarize how within Lord of the Rings there is an element of which all of history is contained, and not only that, but it transcends being historical and it becomes mythical. It becomes almost an eternal truth which transcends mere academic history. And that is what I find, you know, so absolutely fascinating about this. One other aspect which I wanted to talk to is you were talking about, you know, the point of entry in history, how essentially we can construe this within place and time, how this sort of relates to philology. Well, another aspect I want to talk about is the nature of progress and the nature of time itself. So obviously Tolkien was a Catholic, and that very much informed his worldview in terms of history, in terms of progress in history. And you mentioned this idea of EU catastrophe, you know, from this great level of despair and hopelessness, we arrive at the situation where there is some triumphant resolution. I just wanted to ask, you know, I can't help but read, you know, the City of God, St. Augustine of Hippo's conception of a Christian teleology within the works of Tolkien, and essentially that this is, you know, some sort of continuous fight between the heavenly city and the earthly city, between the forces of supreme good, God, Eru Iluvatar, and the forces of eternal negation, corruption, what have you, Sauron, the, you know, ever diminishing returns of evil, what have you. How much would you say this, you know, legitimately informs Tolkien's worldview, and, you know, how much can this really be gleaned from Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion in general, if at all?
How many hours do you want this video to go on? that's a whole nother layer, right? You're right. Yes, it does. You asked me to talk about history. So in the wider scope of what I talk about in my Tolkien videos on unauthorized.tv, I'm dealing specifically with that problem of creation and subcreation and fall. And the Silmarillion is the story of multiple falls, right? And and so, I mean, when you're thinking about, no, seriously, this is a whole nother topic. I'm glad I made you think of it. That you know, Melkor as one of the angels at the singing of the world, and, you know, it's the singing of creation. There's whole layers of things about music and harmony and the way in which his discord becomes incorporated into the story. So that's when when I teach that part of it, we actually read selections from the City of God on the angels. Mm. And to understand that Tolkien, one, he understands that the angels were there at creation, which is kind of part of the apocryphal stories of Christianity. But the angels, but that's what, you know, everybody knows that the angels are there at creation, except it doesn't say it in the Bible. Hmm. It does say it in places like Job, where the morning stars all sing at creation. It's more in the things like the Book of Enoch, which I know some people are quite interested in, because you, or Jubilees, right? There's a description explicitly of day one of creation when the angels are singing the elements into being, and there's all these spirits of the ice and the snow and the winds and so forth. And the Ainur are clearly like that, right? They're elemental angels. And so the whole mystery, and this is why it's like, I was talking about the subset of where Tolkien's imagining our a capacity to get to the myth behind history. But the big field that he's working in is, yes, he wants to understand myth as theologically robust. Mm. And he's going to take you back in time through all of his legendarium to the origin of time, to that moment of creation, mm. which then, because he's Catholic and because for him, the Gospels are where legend and history has met and fused, the principal mystery of the entire thing is the entry of the creator into his creation, which in the chronology of the Lord of the Rings and all of those stories has not happened yet, right? It's pre-Christian in the sense that it is before the incarnation, but it's all shaped yeah. by that understanding that Jesus is Lord of time.
Hmm. No, that's so wonderful.
That's a whole nother thing to unpack. But you're spot on. So yes.
So in terms of so obviously that's one aspect in terms of creation and incarnation, but another particular aspect I want to focus on is this conception of time, which is of course, you know, anti the idea that, you know, history is the next mark of progress, that, you know, through technological innovations, you know, whatever, humanity will rise. But of course, in Tolkien's view, that is completely inverted. Technology is associated with a decline, especially this is exhibited in Isengard, but it's explicit in the Scouring of the Shire. And of course, towards, you know, regarding some sort of looking at the ages of the Silmarillion. So, for example, the First Age, we have the War of the Wrath, and there is some conclusion there. With the Second Age, there is the War of the Last Alliance. There is some sort of, again, EU catastrophe. And then, of course, the Third Age, moving on to the Fourth Age, the destruction of the Ring. So what I find fascinating about this view of history is that there is tangible decline. You know, looking into the Third Age, we have the fall of the House of Aenor, the House of Kings. Gondor is, you know, replaced and set in rule with the House of Stuarts. For example, the Kingdom of Arnor disintegrates. All of these elements, implicit elements of the decline, you know, the decline essentially of earthly civilizations. Yet at the end of these ages, there is some form of triumphant resolution, renewal, redemption, what have you. And again, I can't help but consistently read these Catholic themes into Tolkien's work. Do you think that's fair?
That's fair too. And I think okay, so you're talking about time and technological progress. Of course, progress is this enlightenment satanic fantasy.
Mm, precisely. thank you.
That we can, by our machines, you know, do better than God, right?
Yes.
And that's the aspect of the fall that, you know, Tolkien explores in the Silmarillion, both in Melkor's desire to make something that he thinks Iluvatar has neglected, right? That Iluvatar has mm-hmm. neglected the void, which doesn't exist until Iluvatar actually proposes the themes. But that, you know, more specifically with the characters like Feanor, makes the Silmarils. They're the thing that is, they're his most precious creation. I have lots of meditations on the meaning of those Silmarils, and I think they're, you know, the sort of Catholic imagery behind that is they're the host and a monstrance, right? They're a crystal. They're crystal with a living fire inside.
Yeah.
But that the problem is not that we make things, right? There's also the very positive element of art throughout the story, that, you know, the elves make beautiful, they make the alphabet, they make music, they make clothing, make cities. The Numenoreans are not bad and they want to make things. It's the misuse of our creativity that is the problem. And, you know, interestingly, in the poem, the famous poem that Tolkien wrote for Lewis, Mythopoeia, where he's trying to persuade him that myths have truth in them. One of the things he points to is, you know, we have still our free will, used or misused. We make still by the law in which we are made, right? So everything that Tolkien is meditating on is this tension between art in response to the invitation of the creator to participate in his themes and the satanic, you know, desire to make in spite of God's theme. So it's the problem with modernity is that we're supposed to just, you know, bow down to the satanic and say, oh yes, save us, which is the problem, right? We're not going to be saved by the satanic machines. We're going to be saved one by the, you know, entry of the Lord into history, but we are saved by, you know, working within creation, not against it. And that, you know, so the simplistic sort of enlightenment, yeah, if we are all just rational, we'll, you know, make the world better than God made it. Well, good luck with that, right?
No, thank you. And that's a wonderful elucidation, because it more or less goes off with the theme I was discussing on my previous stream regarding his political philosophy, in that all of these forms, these iterations coming after Melkor are created in spite or as an antithesis towards the true organic form of nature, or the true working of the world, and some form of divine harmony. It is always done in spite of that, or an attempt to, you know, overcome that. And of course, that is, you know, perfectly exhibited in the characters of Melkor, in the characters of Saruman, and in Cumenor in Saruman. And of course, the fate of all these creatures is, again, decline. In the case of Saruman, a almost total oblivion in terms of his all of his ambitions coming to this, you know, very pathetic revenge at the end of the Scouring of the Shire. And you can say an encapsulation of Tolkien's own dystopia and all the themes relating again back not only to the idea of technology and progress being actually inverted in Tolkien's mind view, or again progress as that enlightenment idea, but again linking this back to, you know, his own experiences coming back from the war, etc., or his own experiences of urbanization, industrialization within the West Midlands. So in terms of other broad themes, because this has been a very meta stream, and I haven't really wanted to delve into the particulars, simply because I had you with me, and I really wanted to get into the consensus essentially of what Tolkien's philosophy of history was. Is there anything else before I go into the super chats? Any other points you want to bring up?
Well, so there's still more in the Notion Club papers. So I hope everybody's curious to read them. I keep you're talking about Gondor, and I keep mentioning Gondolin, which is funny, because my last but one episode in Forge of Tolkien was on Gondolin, and I was, you know, like surprised at myself that I'd never like paid attention to Gondolin. I'd never done a lecture on it. If you read the siege, the description of the siege of Gondolin, those are war machines, right? They're like living. The description of them, they sound like something out of, I think it's. I'm not up on my superhero movies, but the Avengers movie where all the it's like segmented monsters come out of the sky. Like tank treads or something, right? So
I'm not the person, by the way,
neither am I clearly, but the you know, the science fiction element in Tolkien's stories is pretty powerful, but it's that he wants it to be both scientific, as with the dreams, and to, as you're saying, you know, give us warnings about the misuse of technology. But he's not anti-tech, right? Because the elves themselves, you know, what they deny that they have magic. It just looks like magic to, you know, people who don't understand how it works. What they do is craft with love of the materials. So it's not anti-tech or pro-tech. It's understanding your relationship to your creator and making within that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. So anything else?
Oh, probably, but why don't you look at the super chats?
No, I'm being serious. I mean, the wonderful thing is, because this is a belated stream, I don't have you under a very strict timetable.
So the last sort of element of the framing that is helpful to have is the Notion Club papers were just one of Tolkien's like failed efforts at time travel story. The other one, the more specific one, is The Lost Road. And it's interesting if you take what I've been saying about the dreams and the philology and the travel, and that The Lost Road was meant to be a story that would go from the present back through pairs of fathers and sons in conversation through the Anglo-Saxon period to the, you know, the Lombards, the, you know, the Paul the Deacons, Lombardy, back to Numenor, right? And Tolkien really only wrote the two poles of that. He wrote the modern period, some sketches on the Anglo-Saxon, and then the Numenorean. But the interesting thing about the whole framing is that the characters alternate in generations the names Elfwin and Oswin, more specifically Elf friend and God friend, right? Yeah. And that, again, showing that Tolkien really wanted to link his stories to our present by way of these characters that could carry the stories. And if you're when you're reading, this is another insight I have from Verlaine Pfleger, but it enriches your reading of The Lord of the Rings a lot, I think. Notice when the characters are called elf friend. They're usually the, like Sam or Frodo, they're storytellers who invite you into the story. And that cascade of frames, it's always what Tolkien is trying to do so that we find ourselves inside. And you know, the great frame that he's working with is that of our being made in the image and likeness of God. And I think what's curious about, I mean, he's very Catholic. He's theologically Catholic. He's liturgically Catholic. There's all sorts of wonderful stuff about the sacraments and so forth, but he's chronologically and historically Catholic in the sense of wanting you to realize what story you're in, right? Mm-hmm. Constantly. And that is, this is my favorite passage that I can almost dupe from memory now, right? When Sam and Frodo are on the stairs of Cirith Ungol and they're talking about finding themselves in the story, right? They look up and see the star and Sam says, ah, we're in the same tale still, right? That's Tolkien's fundamental historical claim. We're in the same tale still. And if you know your Augustine, you realize that's the story of the incarnation, redemption, and salvation. So we're in the same tale still.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And I think that's a wonderful summary. So I'll just get onto the super chats quickly, but thank you so much for that. Right. Okay. A Walrus for 50 krona just says, keep it up. Well, thank you, A Walrus.
Thank you.
Vingle for another 50 Norwegian krona. Tolkien stresses in On Fairy Stories that a tale being a dream story precludes it from being a fairy story. He uses Alice in Wonderland as an example.
And this is, he didn't like it when you broke out of the dream and it was all a fake, right? And I think that's what he doesn't like about Alice in Wonderland is it's not clear the relationship between the dream world that she's been in and her real world. Whereas what they're trying to do, I think he's aghast at the clumsiness of the device, actually. And with the reading that they did of Dunn's Experiment in Time, he wanted the dream practice to actually work, I think, right? Just like his philological studies, he wants to actually get back in time by way of finding the root of what Ent meant, that's a rhyme, or Arundel, right? He disliked the fakery of devices, that, for example, like in Alice in Wonderland.
Wonderful. Ivan 95 for 20 euros. Thank you for a great series, AM. As a new reader of fiction, I can't wait to dive into Tolkien's work after I finish the Space Trilogy. Can we hope for C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton days at some point? C.S. Lewis, I mean, other than having read C.S. Lewis, I'm really not the one who is qualified to talk about him. But G.K. Chesterton, yes, maybe at some point. John Gordon for $10. Thank you for talking to AM. I have a newfound appreciation for Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's work I didn't have before. Well, Thank you very much, John Gordon. And if that's the result of Talking Day and all the wonderful contributions across many channels, then I think that's mission accomplished. So that's the end of the Super Chats. Rachel, is there anything you would like to tell us about or anything you're doing? I mean, regarding links, I've included a link to Unauthorized and your mm-hmm. Forge of Tolkien series. Obviously, you tell us as much about that as possible, but in addition, anything else you'd like to talk about?
Well, on Lewis, if you would like a lovely introduction, particularly to the Space Trilogy stories, but also to Narnia, Michael Ward's Planet Narnia is outstanding. And Ward is, I think he's done another book. I haven't followed up on that properly, but he's got a whole website on Planet Narnia, which will give you a similar kind of framing that Lewis was just as technically sort of precise in his imagining as Tolkien is with his space stories, right? So everything that we've been talking about today about, Tolkien's real wanting to have precision in his imagining of how we could time travel. Lewis did it with the space travel too. So Planet Narnia. Okay. So in the Forge of Tolkien series, there are 43 episodes. The 43rd episode is a special that I did at BasedCon back in September. It was live and talking about the ring. But the first 42 episodes are my introduction to both Tolkien's ideas about creativity and language and storytelling and sort of craft behind the stories. And that's like the first 20 episodes. And then the second 20 are a deep reading of the Silmarillion for the most part, right? Meditating on creation and music. Mm. And there's some occasional episodes that are things like on his thinking about marriage and a special episode when I got my new dog on dogs in Tolkien's story. So there's a lot more in the Unauthorized videos to play off of.
Anything on the Roverandom?
Yes, I talk about Roverandom and why, in fact. So Beren and Lúthien is basically the great story of a girl and her dog save the world.
Yeah.
Because Lúthien is helped by, the hound of Valinor, Juan, who carries her and rescues her and then battles with the hound of Morgoth. And recognizing that dogs and dragons are always there together in Tolkien stories. I'm sort of sorry that he never wrote, proper dog stories, but in fact he did. They're like Farmer Giles, right? There's a Garm and the dragon, right? So if you find dragons, you find dogs, which is a nice segue to my other major link. It's like Tolkien invites us to subcreate with him, right? And this in my campus class that I've taught since 2005, the students are invited to subcreate with Tolkien within his legendarium, right? And write poems, you write stories, we make music and things like that. But I realized in this last year or so that I needed to answer my own challenge of writing within the medieval mode of subcreation that Tolkien is, I think, trying to invite us to, which is a very Catholic in the sense of both theologically and artistically exercise. So the other place I'd like you to visit is dragoncommonroom.com. My poets and I have written two poems now, one modeled on Alexander Pope's Dunciad, which is a satire for grown-ups, and it's a little dark. But the one that just came out before Christmas is a poem about the light, and some animals go in search of the light and find it in Antarctica. And we're gonna have a challenge if you want to like compete for a prize of some signed copies. But the problem being, how do we as Christians write the kind of stories that we would like to read more of, as Tolkien and Lewis said they wish they would? And that's been our ambition and quest in Dragon Common Room. So please visit our website.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Just on things for the channel, obviously, I'll get back to the main podcast. I'll be talking about the Counter-Reformation. I'll probably put out a video on that on Thursday, I hope, about 8 o'clock. There will be the first episode of the new Tolkien series on Friday. And then on the following Monday, I will be back to my usual podcast with Columba and potentially you will see Marcus Furious Pertinax there as well. So do check in for that. Other than that, please like and share this video and leave a comment. Thank you, as always, to all channel members and people who've donated over on Subscribestar. I want to thank you again profusely, Rachel, for joining me today. It has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much. Sadly, I'm still getting over a bit of a cold, so I've not been as talkative as I usually am, unfortunately, but almost a relief, because this is almost a first where I have diligently sort of been listening and taking in all of your wonderful insights, as opposed to to barreling out all of these points and stunning my guests into submission. So thank you so much. One final super chat, which has come in by Darth Kilhoon for $2. Thank you very much. I finally made it to a stream. Love Tolkien Day. Well, thank you so much, Darth Kilhoon. And this is the final stream of Tolkien Day, and I'll add it to the playlist. I'll put it before our political philosophy stream with Knavenhood, Mr. Patriarch, Coulomb, and Radical Liberation. Thank you all very much for listening. Thank you to Rachel for being such a wonderful guest, and good night.